I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Loretta Napoleone is an acclaimed and best-selling author whose reporting on terrorism, security, and economics has made her a sought-after analyst and public speaker throughout the world. Her new book is Merchants of Men, How Jihadists and ISIS Turn Kidnapping and Refugee Trafficking into a Multi-Billion Dollar Business. It's just been published, and it looks at how terrorist groups and criminals have developed a sophisticated infrastructure to not only transport those they've kidnapped as well as deliver migrants to the West, all the while cultivating a multi-billion dollar business. Ms. Napoleone charts the course of these traffickers from just after September 11, 2001, and the Patriot Act that was put in law soon after, thereby changing how traffickers made money and transported drugs. I'll get Ms. Napoleone to tell us about her book, about the dark side of globalization, and perhaps how Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb and ISIS could be defeated. Among the previous books Loretta Napoleone has written include The Islamist Phoenix, Rogue Economics and Terror Networks. She is chair of the Countering Terrorism Financing Group for the Club de Madrid. Her website is at lorettanapoleone.net. This new book is published by Seven Stories Press, which is distributed in Canada by Penguin Random House. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program in New York City last week, Loretta Napoleone. Ms. Napoleone, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how often are people kidnapped? And I'm just interested to know in the numbers, because, and I ask this, and it might seem like a silly question, but because if it is such a problem, why don't we hear about it in the news, in the media?
Well, to a certain extent, this can be defined as a silent crime. So the media does talk about kidnapping, but generally only when people are released. So we don't know what's happened to the people that are not released, mm-hmm. for example. The politicians follow a strategy whereby people are told not to talk with anybody, not to publicize their ordeal, to forget about what happened, because they do not want to attract attention on a crime, which is very much a sort of crime related to the very mistakes we have made in our foreign policy. So, of course, now we're talking about, you know, one specific type of kidnapping, which is kidnapping of foreigners by, you know, jihadists or people related to them. So often people go traveling in a certain region. They think, you know, they can go and help the refugees, and then, you know, they become prey of the kidnappers because we have no perception of how bad the situation is in these parts of the world.
So how do these kidnappers, how do they determine who to kidnap? I mean, what makes a valuable hostage, say?
Well, if you're a foreigner and you are in Syria or you're in Iraq or Libya, for example, even Egypt to a certain extent, you are worth some money. Of course, if you are Italian, you're worth more money than if you are from Greece, because the Italian pay much more than anybody else. But when they snatch you, generally they don't even know from where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. It's the simple fact that you are a European or a Western. And for Western, we're not only referring to North Americans or Europeans. It's also South Americans. It's also Japanese. Mm-hmm. Anybody that is not from those parts of the world where you get kidnapped is worth some money.
It's
quite shocking.
So it is a billion-dollar industry. So who pays these ransoms? I mean, are these the families? Are these the governments? I mean, you mentioned that the Italians pay more. I guess the government has a policy there of paying these ransoms, do they?
Well, in Italy, it's always the government. So it changed from countries to countries, of course, but most European countries, the government will step in, do the negotiation, and pay the ransom. In Canada, for example, the government officially doesn't pay. Well, the Italian also say that they don't pay, but they do. But in Canada, they follow more or less the same policy of the United States. So the strategy is to offer the kidnappers a sort of compensation for their cost, which is never as high as the ransom, of course. But then families often, if they are frustrated by the way the government handles the situation, which is generally the case, because you know, the strategy of the government is just to stall, wait and see what's happened, then family often employ private companies to get their loved ones out, so also to negotiate the ransom. I think one of the most important cases, or at least the one that most people know in Canada, is the one of Amanda Lindholm, which eventually was brought home through the intervention of a private company from the United Kingdom.
When you talk in the book, I guess, about this infrastructure that's been developed, and it's something that's come out of the post 9/11 days after the Patriot Act institution. This was a way of bringing drugs from Central America to Europe, and that infrastructure has now been used to smuggle hostages and traffic people.
Yes, so there is a distinct link between the response to 9/11. So it's not 9/11 per se, but it's the response. So if you look at kidnapping of foreigners before 2003, when there was the first kidnapping of 32 Europeans in the Sahel by a group of jihadists that then became Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. If you look at the kidnapping before, it was not as common as it then became after 2003. It was also very political. So you would have kidnapping in Chechnya, for example, but the kidnapping in Chechnya was not necessarily to get money, but it was to then execute the hostage in order to send a message to the enemy. Several Russian soldiers were kidnapped and then executed. So it was a different approach. It was not necessarily commercial approach. Well, from 2003, really kidnapping foreigners and collecting the ransom became one of the primary sources of funding terrorist organization, armed organization, which I define as criminal jihadist, because in reality they use this sort of ideological umbrella of being jihadist, but in reality most of the people within this organization were acting as criminals. They were criminals, and they committed crimes because they wanted to make money, not because they wanted to fund the jihad.
Yeah. And so the human trafficking element, are these generally refugees? I mean, are they also slaves, like say, we hear of sex slaves and the sort? I mean, are they used on this infrastructure to get to other countries?
Well, I think that's the trafficking. So basically what happened is that in 2003, they started to kidnap foreigners with the money that they made. They founded armed organizations such as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. And then at a certain point, as the business started to die out, because of course the more people they snatched, the less people would go traveling to these countries.
Right.
Then they start looking at alternative source of funding. And this was getting involved in human trafficking. The human trafficking was a booming business already by 2008, 2010, especially from West Africa, from East Africa, because there is a process of massive destabilization in these countries. And partly, for example, in the case of West Africa, it is linked to the cocaine trade, which after 9/11, with the introduction of the Patriot Act, cocaine started traveling to reach Europe via West Africa and the Sahel, while before it was traveling from the U.S. to Europe. So there are all this process going on. So at that point, it became clear that that infrastructure that had been put in place for smuggling and then for kidnapping could be used for trafficking. And this is where you see the phenomenon of trafficking for, you know, for sex slaves, kidnapping people along the route several times in order to get their family to pay more and more money for the journey. So this is when things really start to get nasty. But at the same time, also, you can see that this is a long-term, very secure business, because the more the countries get destabilized, you know, the more people will want to escape. And the numbers confirm that, you know, from 2008 to today, the number of refugees has increased exponentially. So that is a very good business for these criminal jihadists.
Now, but back to kidnapping for just a sec, because we heard this of this phenomenon in the news of pirates kidnapping. I mean, yeah. are they of the same element, the same method, say, in terms of kidnapping?
Yeah, I mean, the pirates, what they do is they hijack
ships.
And then, of course, they kidnap the crew. So it's almost two activity in one. The principle is identical, so you actually, you know, make money through the ransom, and the ransom it refers not only to the crew but also to the ship. But the difference between piracy and kidnapping is that, you know, piracy is actually capital intensive activity, because of course, you know, you have to have a ship, you can hijack another ship. So here we have a model where you have investors, people that actually invest in chartering the ship, or of course, not chartering the ship, but stealing ships that then, you know, get used for hijacking. But also you need to have a crew that is highly skilled, because you need to have people that know how to be a sea, so you need sailors. So you get this group of investors that invest money, and they pocket most of the ransom. So the ransom there can be between 65% to 75% of the ransom, and the rest is actually divided among the group that carries out jacking, and of course that keeps also the hostages. So that's a different kind of model, but the way it works is identical, which is, at the end of the day, in these highly destabilized areas where there is total political anarchy, this becomes the only source of revenues for the local population. So you get all the local population being involved one way or another in this kind of activity, and you get the local population not condemning this kind of activity, because, of course, this is their sustenance formal economy.
The way that this book reads almost, and you'll forgive me for sounding trite, is that it seems like a travel guide for places not to go.
Yes, I should think that this is a very good description of what this book presents, is the fact that there is a very large section of the world today that it is a no-go area for Westerners, a large section of the world that before the fall of the Berlin Wall was actually a place where people go on holiday.
Right.
People would visit. That per se, I think, is incredibly shocking. I mean, people don't go and visit the pyramids anymore because they're afraid of being kidnapped or of terrorist activity.
Yeah.
They don't go on the beaches of Tunisia, for example, anymore because they're afraid of such the same thing. So I would say that instead of saying, oh, the world is flat, right, because of globalization, we should say that the world has shrunk because of globalization. Mm. And that's not a very good conclusion of a process which we thought it was going to improve our living conditions, that was going to make things easier for all of us.
Yeah, well, one of the things that also struck me in reading this book and has interested me about your work is that is your ability to talk with the sources that you have. I mean, throughout your career, you've had sources that are in government, terrorists, negotiators. In this book, I mean, you talk to hostages. What do you think it is about you and your work that you've been able to gain, say, the trust and confidence of the many sources that you've had?
I think in terms of members of armed organization, possibly one can say it's like the snowball effect, because I started with the Red Brigades a long time ago in 1993. And then because I spoke with them, other groups talked to me, and then other group talked to me. So it's the fact that you have established a certain kind of reputation, that they trust that you will say what they're saying without revealing the sources or without putting their life in danger. In terms of hostages and families of hostages, I think there are a lot of people that want to talk, but they don't know how to talk. They don't know with whom to talk. Of course, if you go and try to approach them and say, oh, I'm writing an article for a newspaper, that people get very suspicious. If you approach them and say, I'm doing a serious research and I want to understand, I'm writing a book, it's actually easier to get people to open up because you establish a relationship, which is not necessarily one based upon one meeting, but it's based upon a dialogue that can go on for several months. Governments, that's actually is the tricky, I would say, you know, that's very tricky, because government officers, people involved in hostage negotiation, they actually do not want to talk to you. So you have to find the few people that do have a consciousness about the whole thing, and they do want to denounce the way the governments actually act. That was, to me, there were two areas that for me were very, very difficult. One, of course, were the government, and the other one, believe it or not, were the aid agencies.
Really?
So, yeah, I had big problems with them because they are as secretive, if not even more, than the government.
Yeah.
They don't want people to know what they do. They don't want people to know what they do with the money. They don't want people to know anything about their the way they function, and that's very upsetting.
Yeah.
Very upsetting.
This isn't at face value a terribly uplifting book or topic. So how do you view the future? Is it as bleak as it seems for a lot of people?
I think, you know, I see the future extremely bleak. I see information being even more manipulated as it is. I mean, the public will know even less in the future than we know now, because there is a willingness not to publicize this kind of information, but also I think people don't want to hear this story. People don't want to hear negative stories. They actually want to forget about the failures of the last 25 years, and they want to concentrate on the positive, which is a typical behavior of society when they start breaking down.
Yeah.
And I think Western society is beginning to break down because democracy is clearly not working. Politics has become a dirty word. So there are all these elements, I think, that compound towards a sort of indifference to what is really happening in the world. And that's the best possible formula for a major disaster. Because that's why jihadism today is much, much more stronger than it was 15 years ago, right after 9/11 or before 9/11.
So what does the election in November mean for the short term in terms of this world that we live in?
I think the election in November, it is going to play a role because depending on who is going to be elected, we may have an acceleration of military conflict or we may have a pause. So I think Hillary Clinton for sure will be very hawkish in the Middle East, which is not necessarily positive at all. I think she's also will get in a collision course with Vladimir Putin because the two of them, they don't like each other. There is a huge resentment. So also I think Hillary Clinton has a vision of the world that belongs to the past. I don't think she really has grasped how the world has changed since her husband was president, in terms of foreign policy, in terms of also international relationship. Donald Trump, I would think that he's not really interested in foreign policy. I mean, the guy is not a proper politician.
Right.
So it very much will depend on what the vice president will manage to put forward, because I mean, it'd be down to him to formulate any kind of political agenda. But at the same time, I think he will make a deal with Putin.
Trump will.
Yeah, I think he will seek a sort of appeasement, a sort of cooling down of the relationship that there are at the moment between the White House and the Kremlin, and that I think is going to be positive for the Middle East in general, and also for the West. I mean, that doesn't mean that Vladimir Putin is going to bring democracy to the Middle East, but I think it will decrease the military tension inside the Middle East if we have both the White House and the Kremlin wanting to put an end to this conflict.
You end the book, the epilogue of the book ends with Brexit. So what's happening in Europe, and what does that mean for the rest of us? And does that mean that globalization is over?
I think globalization, of course, is over. We have tried globalization several times in history, and yes, it always failed. So clearly, this desire of creating a global village is not working. I mean, it's not working for a series of reasons. It's not even working economically speaking, because at the end of the day, we are less wealthy today than we were before. So I think Brexit is the result of the failures of the EU to produce a winning formula for an entire continent. So I wouldn't say that Brexit is a vote of refusal. I would say more that the Brexit is just a confirmation of a failure. It should be seen in these terms. Now, of course, the Europeans have condemned it, But then at the same time, as you can see, Brexit is not causing major changes. They haven't kicked out the British.
Yeah.
Everything is slowing down in terms of negotiation. At the end of the day, not even the refusal to be part of Europe has prompted in Europe a clear response. So what is this Europe? It's a big question, right?
Yeah. Well, this is a terribly fascinating book, Loretta. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you so much.
The book is called Merchants of Men, How Jihadists and ISIS Turned Kidnapping and Refugee Trafficking into a Multi-Billion Dollar Business. It's published by Seven Stories Press. Its author, Loretta Napoleoni, joined me on the line from New York. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Punter.